Welcome to Just Another Wine podcast. Today, you're joined by all three of us. I'm Emily Harmon.
I'm Doug Gregg.
And I'm Jamie Good.
What are we talking about today, gents?
Today's topic is terroir.
Taste the place.
Can we taste the place?
Why have you gone a bit piratey?
This is pirate radio. It's weird. We're broadcasting from a boat in the Thames Estuary, apparently. Yeah, this is a subject that particularly fascinates me, and I'm sure fascinates you. And we can get all nerdy about it, but let's get more nuts and bolts to begin with. So I'm going to set a scenario, just imagine yourself in a vineyard. Let's say Chablis for the sake of the argument. There's another vineyard just across the road. I taste the grapes. There doesn't seem to be any difference. The vines are set up in the same way. And what I put in my mouth and crunch into, two entirely different flavour profiles. I think, what? How does that happen? I go down the road to the winery itself, and the winemaker's there, and he has two tanks. In one tank is wine from one of the vineyards, and the other tank is wine from the other vineyard. And this is the finished wine. It's just before it's about to be bottled. And I taste the wine again, and they are incredibly different. So what is going on here? Even my uncultured palate can taste the difference. How is it, I ask myself, that despite all the chemical and microbiological transformations occurring during the winemaking process, that must surely alter the essential nature of the grapes and the wine itself. There are clear differences between the wines. And I wonder if we might innocently wonder, is this the result of terroir? So perhaps we need a textbook definition of terroir just to get us sort of rolling. And of course, we're going to qualify everything 100 times. For me, terroir is all that defines the wine in and of itself, its identity, all the preconditions and causes and actions that make the wine what it is. So we'll start with the macroclimate, as it's called rather formally, but that's the sort of the climate of the wider region. You know, maybe the Loire might be one, or northern Burgundy might be another. And then we move slowly inwards towards the mesoclimate, as it's known, which is a reference to the specific vineyard in which the specific vineyard and the conditions in which that vineyard is set up. And finally, to microclimate, which is the immediate environment around the vineyard and even the grapevines itself and certain blocks of grapes. Then we can be a bit more precise. We can talk about terroir in terms of the altitude of the vines, the aspect or orientation of them. In other words, which direction the vines are facing, the drainage, the plant life around the vines, the soil life and soil type, and the very bedrock underneath the vines themselves. So it's from the sun to the soil. Soleil, sol. Anyway, that is the basic, that's the background, but surely we need to be able to put some more flesh on this so we can really understand why a wine tastes different from one vineyard to another, and why is it that a lot of people revere terroir and talk about it, casually. Can we actually make it a bit more definite? Jamie, what do you think?
Oh, this is such a big subject, and it's kind of like the foundational theory that underpins fine wine as we know it. Because we pay more from a wine that comes from a specific site than we would from a generic wine. And, you know, there's so many ways of approaching that. But I think one way of approaching it is this idea that you see terroir in the differences between wines. It's evident in the flavour differences in the wines, but the roots of that flavour difference we're postulating are in the physical site of the vineyard. So it's a combination of soils, it's a combination of all the factors you mentioned, the physical site of the vineyard, seen through the lens of a particular grape variety or grape varieties. And you mentioned tasting the grapes. Well, it's actually very interesting because I imagine that tasting terroir in grapes is quite difficult. It's much more difficult than tasting it in the wine. But evidently, what is present in what we're thinking about terroir is already present in those grapes. It's just revealed through the act of fermentation. And so immediately it becomes apparent that there's a partnership between the wine grower and the place that results in a wine that has a signature of a place. So there's a level of interpretation involved here. And the way I like to look at it is this idea of music. I like music. I love music and I like playing guitar, and I'm not a very good singer. I only sing when I'm drunk with friends.
I've heard you sing quite a bit.
It's the idea that you take the place is the score or the chord sheet. It's the song as a notation of the song, but it requires that somebody to play that song and sing it, then to bring that song into reality. And this is where the art of the wine grower is crucial, because you know there's lots of things you can do that can obscure that message. You can have noise and that kind of drowns out that beautiful signature of place. And likewise, you can have different interpretations of that same place that are equally valid. So you could have wine growers working in the same vineyard, producing versions of that vineyard that have capturing that place in a unique way, but in a way that really captures that place. But it's different from the neighbouring vigneron and the neighbouring vigneron. And so this is where it becomes very interesting and very complicated. It's this idea of, and the other one I like is this idea of tuning a radio, the old radios, where you get a signal and, I'm recognising a signal. And then you tune it a bit more to get that signal in tune. So I remember going on camping holidays to France and Spain. I used to love listening to Tesmas Special. It's on Longwave 198, a Radio 4 Longwave. And you could, it kind of, Longwave meant you could pick it up just, but in the north of France, not in the south of France. So I used to love when we got back into range and just trying to find that signal on the radio. I guess it's like that when you make a wine from a site, you recognise that site's got characters. Obviously, you're using the lens of a different variety, specific variety or groups of varieties to show that signal. And you then fine-tune it. You adapt your wine-making approach or your picking date or whatever to what you think shows that terroir most clearly.
So terroir is almost an intuitive relationship between the vigneron, who's like the more the conductor in this scenario, and the unique nature of the land, the vineyard, but in this case, understanding what needs to be done each year. So terroir is not necessarily a constant. It is like a song, but it changes according to every vintage because
more like the circumstances.
I think it's a great description, a continual conversation between the vigneron and the vineyard. Emily, what are your thoughts?
No, I'm glad you said that, Jamie. I was hoping you were going to say that anyway, because I think the human factors, not usually spoken about. I think there's a lot of light shone on soil being one of the kind of key factors in terroir. And we obviously think we probably all agree on the fact that soil does play a really important role in the final wine. But just even thinking about the soil health in which the vine is growing in, that's very dependent on the decisions that person makes, right? Like, what is the life in that soil doing? What's the mineral uptake going to be from that vine because of the decisions of the person who is the steward of that parcel of land? The thoughts, I feel like you two have both encapsulated the definition of terroir quite concretely, but I think the question that I have for both of you is, what do you think is the most relevant or, let's say, important factor of all the, like, all of the little inputs that create this idea of terroir? So we talk about soil, we talk about weather, we talk about climate, we talk about grape variety, we talk about the human factor. We also can also talk a little bit about cultural heritage as well. Traditions in the place also impact that final wine and the story of that wine and what we end up experiencing. Do you think there's one factor that is most significant or that stands out the most as the most impactful?
Well, as Jamie said, I think the choices of the vignerons, and there are hundreds and hundreds,
human factor
over the growing season, like months and months, the human factor is really important. For me, the nature of and the quality of farming, because ultimately we're growing grapes, the connection between the vine and the soil, the encouraging root systems to delve deep and, pick up minerals, pick up yeasts. And then I think, of course, terroir can be undone, like anything. It can be undone by clunky farming, bad winemaking, overuse of chemicals, overuse of enological tropes. I'm not saying that you can't make terroir without interventions. Interventions are necessary. They're constant, they're physical. But again, it comes back to engaging with the wine and tasting the wine and understanding the true voice of the wine. I think the more you try to manipulate the wine, then the further away you get from that expression of singularity, which is what terroir is. It's not the same. The wine is never the same 2 years running, or it shouldn't be, otherwise then you've sacrificed that the voice of the vineyard. Jamie?
I think I'd say, all in all, it's the soils that are most important, because I think there's, you know, when you travel the world, you see the site differences between two sites that are adjacent to each other. And when we talk about climate, obviously a vine never sees a climate. The climate's an average. So the vine sees weather of the year. And where you have consistent site signatures showing up in the wine year after year, where the climate or the weather has been quite different across those different years, then you're saying that it's something that's more permanent than climate that's conveying this local character to the wines. And there's a study by Uli Fischer, who's at Neustadt in Germany. He's a researcher, and he looked at terroir in Riesling, and he did lots of vineyard sites and then did these spider plots of the sensory work from there. And what he showed is that compare, for instance, Moselle and Rheinhessen, quite different wine regions. But in the Moselle, you've got one site with red clay soils, Erzige Wirtsgarten. And then the Rheinhessen, most of that is red clay. And the flavour signature of the Riesling was so similar in those two sites, where they're quite far apart, very different climates. But the Riesling had a similar flavour signature when you did the sensory work, which the logical explanation of that is that the soil type is shaping something, you know, indirectly. Obviously, it's not just translocation of soil elements to the grapes that's then causing the wines to have different flavour, but it's shaping the way those grapes develop and the sort of flavour precursors they accumulate indirectly, maybe through altering gene expression or something, that is giving you a similarity between sites that have the same soil but different climates. And for me, that's very interesting.
But isn't terroir even more subtle? I mean, if microclimate is the climate around almost an individual vine, then the nuances can be incredible. I mean, if you
the can, nuances can be incredible, but they won't be consistent across years, because you see that there'll be a different weather each year. So the say, for instance, you've got two sites that are adjacent and they produce quite different wines, like in Burgundy. That parcellation in Burgundy is remarkable. You know, it's at 1,247 climats. And, you know, if you had a village level site that you could give care and attention to, and so it would produce a wine that's, you know, equivalent to a Grand Cru, then you would do that. And people do that, and they can't, you know. They occasionally you get Premier Crus that are better than Grand Crus. Occasionally you get village level wines better than Premier Crus. But in you know, through history, these climates have maintained their position. So where you're seeing small differences over a small geographic areas, then the differences in microclimate that the grapes are seeing will vary more than from one season to another, than from one site to another. So that suggests that it's actually the physical, you know, thing in the site that's the same every year is going to be the more dominant feature.
When I was doing a harvest at Commando G in 2018, with Danny and Fair, it was quite interesting because we did blind wines every night, like, which is quite common when you do harvest. I mean, you guys have done harvest, right? Like at the end when you have dinner. And the guys were really focused on every time that we tried blind wines that we had to guess the soil that the vine, like that the wine we were trying was coming from. And that was the first time I'd really looked at blind wine, like blind wine tasting that way. At first, I was like, wow, this is a bit abstract, right? But actually, it was a really great tool to start focusing on soil expression in the wine, because once you can grasp that, or at least attempt to grasp it, It gets much easier to start guessing where wines come from. So then if once you know what a volcanic soil tastes like or how it expresses itself in the final wine, then you can be like, okay, this limits this to these geographical places. So if it's these geographical places, what's it probably made from? What's the alcohol showing itself to be? What's the acidity showing itself to be? What's the ripeness of the grapes? And then it becomes a kind of a different approach of like getting to the end result, which you hope for with blind wine, which, I'm very humbled to say that doesn't always happen very often, but like at least you can strive for it. And I think the growers kind of intuitively understand that the importance of the soil and how it really expresses this sense of place, that you can taste the origin, if you like, in the final wine. And I think sometimes, at least with my sommelier background, that's not really how I taught wine tasting in my early days of my career. It was really like, guess what the grape is? Think about it from a winemaking perspective, which was kind of a backwards view on it.
Wasn't there a period of time, I seem to remember working in restaurants as well, when terroir became almost unfashionable as a concept, when the embracing of the varietalization, as they called it, that the variety was the signature and the terroir was irrelevant. Terroir was just soil, ground, earth. You know, anyone can plant a vine in earth. And yet it's extraordinary when you taste wine blind, as you said, Emily, that you can detect the adjectives you use to describe the wine are granitic, salty, you know, volcanic. And it's not as if you're not working back from knowing the terroir. That's what you automatically imagine or taste in your mind's eye. And then it turns out to be true. So how is it? What is being transported, Jamie, in these sort of flavours, these flavour impressions? Why does wine taste volcanic? Why does it taste granitic? Presuming that means terroir exists as a single, you know, for these singular distinctions to take place.
I think we have to think about, where does the flavour of wine come from? So evidently, when you harvest grapes, the flavour of the wine is going to be, from that point onwards, what is in those grapes, or maybe in the stems as well, because if you've got a whole bunch component, then you've got the stems in the mix as well. So everything's going to come from there. So in the grapes, you've got some components, their flavour components, that make it through fermentation, and then they're going to be, you know, present in the wine. So there's relatively few of those flavour components that go all the way through to, like, methoxypyrazines would be a good example. They're present in the grapes and you taste them in the wine. Then you've got precursors present in the grapes that are then transformed by the yeast during fermentation, and also the malolactic bacteria if malolactic fermentation takes place. And those components change form, or so you can have precursors that, like the precursors to the polyfunctional thiols that give that sort of passion fruit and grapefruit and sort of elderflower character to Sauvignon Blanc, for instance. Those are precursors present in the grapes that don't taste, but they're transformed by the yeast and suddenly they become aroma compounds. So you've got those two elements. Then you've got obviously acids, which change during fermentation a bit as well, but largely are what's present in the grapes. Then you've got flavour components that are produced entirely by the yeasts, the activity of the yeast and, of course, the bacteria. So those are manufactured de novo. So effectively what you're seeing there is you're seeing the must as a growth medium for microbes. So you change the characteristics of the must, that will change how the microbes grow, and it will change the sort of components that the microbes produce, which I think is really interesting. So you've got these three different elements. So the grape-derived flavour compounds, the grape precursors that are transformed by the microbes, and then the stuff the microbes make. And so in some ways what terroir is doing is it's producing grape composition, bearing in mind these three different components, and also very importantly producing a medium for growth for microbes that then will cause the production of a range of different flavour compounds. And so it's very indirect in that sense. But so when we're looking at terroir, what we're looking at is we're looking at how the site characteristics influence the production of these different compounds. And then, of course, you've got the microbes. And another question is, where do the microbes come from? Are you using microbes that are present in the vineyard to come in on the grapes, or are you adding them, inoculating? And so this is all very interesting. It's all different sort of layers of... And then, of course, we have flavour compounds that come from the process of élevage, and largely they would be like oak-derived compounds when you use oak. You might have some compounds that come from, say, for instance, if you use terracotta, there may be some flavour compounds in the terracotta. I don't think it's completely neutral. But all these things together produce the final wine. And I think it's really interesting. The question is how much... is that signal degraded or amplified during that winemaking process? And I think a really skilled winemaker looks to amplify the local signature. But clumsy winemaking, you know, picking too late or even picking too early, doesn't allow the terroir signature to come through strongly. And then obviously, if you do all sorts of things, like if you adjust the must or if you acidify or if you... You don't have cleanliness during your fermentation process, you get some wine faults developing, or you have, you know, maybe a heavy-handed approach with oak, then you're producing things, you're introducing elements that maybe degrade that signal. And so the classic sort of big international red wine at 15% alcohol, 100% new oak, 29 bricks, you know, harvest, that sort of thing is just doesn't matter where it comes from. You've really just completely lost any sense of place whatsoever.
It's that tightrope, though, isn't it, of trying to amplify or express terroir, but equally doing the work to not obscure it. Finding that balance.
But don't you think a lot of growers, they want to vaunt their terroir, whether they've expressed it admirably or not within the wine. But then, Jamie, you're talking about almost like the must or the eventual grape juice, the wine, almost in an objective way. What about the subjective side? Is like people taste terroir differently in different wines. Some people taste, their first impression is, yeah, that's got tremendous minerality. It's a beautiful expression of terroir. Some probably don't taste that at all. They taste more the extraneous factors like the élevage of the wine or the varietal or whatever. So for me, terroir is like there's a certain imponderable element of the whole thing. You know when it's there, or you sense when it's there, but you can't quite define it because it's this unifying. It's unifying all the elements so they're in harmony, rather than certain elements standing out much more than others, unless you believe that you are tasting granite and you are tasting volcanic soils. Is that possible? Or can we be tasting these particular elements within the wine?
Well, I would say that when we say we're tasting granite, we're saying we're tasting the impact of granite on wine flavour, not tasting granite itself. And I think granitic soils are very interesting because I think they often give, I would say they give kind of bright, focused fruit flavours. There's almost like a linear quality to granitic wines, whereas schist, for instance, would be much broader flavours, the way you feel it in the mouth. But I wouldn't say I was tasting schist or I was tasting granite.
You must, Emily, you must feel this having worked at Commando G and heard Danny and Fur talk about there's not just granite, it's granite with quartz or granite on sand. But for them, granite is all about verticality in the mouth. You know, it's lifted, whereas schist is like, and volcanic is sort of broader, you know, broader. It describes like a sort of richer, broader, warmer shape. Limestone is another soil that they say is, you know, it gives the same properties as granite, or, you know, that verticality or linear, actually, linear dimension to the wines. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I always find wines on limestone to have almost like, I think of it a little bit like a firework. So that vertical expression that you describe, but then this kind of almost like melting sensation at the end, you know, like when a firework fizzles out. Whereas if I was to compare that to wines that I have tried from volcanic soils, I find them to be very uncompromising, like a perception of freshness that I don't find necessarily in other wines that starts from the beginning. It's almost like a wave coming in, a very large wave that literally breaks and powers through from the break all the way to the coast. And then with that sort of added saltiness, smokiness, savoury quality that you get, at least that I perceive in volcanic wines. And I agree with Jamie on the on that that delicacy, that lifted delicacy and that brightness and, yeah, like a lifted perfume that I find in granite wines. And, especially Grados for a number of reasons. Like that, it's a very special combination of factors that make those wines... That full-bodied wine's ethereal, you know, like it's very beautiful. But yeah, I think it's something that, again, we don't talk about enough as sommeliers, right? Like I haven't had many of these conversations with somms. It's always with winemakers or nerds like you two. But I think for me, this was part of the wine course that I ran this year, was really getting people to blind taste wine, introduce the concepts of how you might perceive a certain soil in the expression of the final wine, and then getting them to taste the wines blind, different soils, but with the same grapes, for example, and then seeing if somebody could perceive any nuance or difference or this soil expression. And, you know, this was with people that had just done the WSET level 3, weren't necessarily working in wine roles, but working in F&B roles. And actually, like, again, it's only anecdotal from my own very limited survey on that, but like people can grasp that concept quite quickly, actually, and guess quite accurately. So I think there's something also quite intuitive about thinking about wine that way.
Yeah, intuitive
well.
And associative. Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you think about it, yes, we're interested in the nuts and bolts, how the wine works, you know, in a sort of clockwork way. But actually, when we taste, we close our eyes and we're transported to a place and we allow sensory impressions to wash over our palate. And I think then we experience wine at a sort of maybe a deeper level, or perhaps a more rarefied level. I don't know. But we're not sort of analysing too much. But then when we unpick the wine, and actually here I'm going to sort of like do a bit of unpicking and just ask Jamie a couple of sort of tech questions. Stay tuned. One is pH of soils and pH of wine. Does this help? Is this precursor towards for mineral expression in wines? Does it enhance our appreciation? Low pH, is it good?
That's a good question. I mean, looking at sort of granitic soils tend to be higher pH, and obviously limestone soils tend to be lower pH, but they both make very interesting soils, very interesting wines, you know. And so I think that that's maybe too much of a simplistic sort of dial down. But I would say, though, one thing is that, you know, there's two things that fascinate me about terroir. One is this idea that not all sites are created equal. So some sites are really good for growing wine grapes that make fantastic wines, yeah. Some sites like, yeah, it makes a perfectly good table wine, a quaffer, but it's not going to make something interesting and profound. So we have terroir on one level, which is about the potential ceiling for quality from a particular site. Then we have the other sense of terroir is like, can you recognize the place in the wine? And that's fascinating. You know, for me as a geek, I don't necessarily want a wine to taste great, just for it to taste honestly of its place. And it's like, I can't appreciate, you know, I don't want to taste the perfect wine every time. I want to taste wines that sometimes challenge me a little, that are different. And so on one level, we've got terroir as a potential, you know, could say, well, you know, maybe the great thing about this terroir is it gives me a wine of a certain quality that I might blend with another wine of a certain quality and end up with something very, very high end. You can't dial down from that wine to site, because in a sense that site has been lost through blending. It doesn't mean that blending wines means that terroir doesn't matter, because you need good terroir to make good blending components. And then the other level is that sort of parcellation, where we really like to try something. You know, if you're a wine grower, it must be fascinating to know that that corner of your vineyard gives you something very different to this. Even if you blend them together, you know, you taste that difference reproducibly over the years. And then that also brings together this sort of notion of scale. So you could say, well, I recognize, you know, New Zealand Pinot Noir, I recognize this. You know, you could say on a good day with a favourable wind, you could probably sit with a table of New Zealand Pinot Noir and maybe with 70% accuracy, allocate the Pinot Noirs to Central Otago, Martinborough or Marlborough or North Canterbury. You know, if you know a bit about New Zealand Pinot Noir, you know, obviously not 100%. I don't think anyone could do that. Fakers, maybe. But no, there's at one level, there's a scale. Or you might say, well, this is a Californian Chardonnay and this is Burgundy Chardonnay. You might do that. So that's the whole sort of pan-regional sort of scale as well. But then you've got the within one vineyard looking at the different sites and different plots. So you've got this terroir operating at multiple scales, which I think is also quite interesting as well.
Yeah, I've got a couple of observations. One is that obviously in some regions, these vineyards have been mapped for 1,000, sometimes even 2,000 years. So Clos de Vignemaine, which was planted by the monks from the Abbey at Cluny in 910, supposedly, when they actually did analysis of the they sent up a drone to look at it, the Romans were making wine there, had planted vineyards there 1,000 years previously. So there's something sacred about the vineyard site. Now flip that over, someone who planted vines in a place that they really like, maybe 5-10 years ago, which has no reputation for vine growing particularly, but it's just a great place with really nice soils and lovely climate, like Vermont for the sake of argument, can great wines, can a terroir establish itself in the wine in a really short space of time, is my question to you both.
That's, I think we question. Need a glass of wine for that.
And I
day.
Think we've got the wine that may wine that may help us to think about that question. So I just open it.
That was a genuine sound.
So this is let me pour it for you. This is from a wine grower in South Africa called Saki Mouton. And the wine itself comes from a region called Olifants Riviere, which is also referred to as it's like it's a larger region. It's got things like Skurfberg, an informal name for its sister Stahl, even Pekingese, I think, is Cedarberg is in Olifants Riviere. So this is a Colombar 2023, and it's called Vlodvlak from Saki Mouton. And think about Colombar is this, that these vines originally planted, they're on sort of like I've got the term for the soils. They're not
like a silt, no?
Silty soils. Silty soils.
Silt and sandstone.
And the cover, the label of the wine, it shows when the vineyard was flooded 1 year. And it's anyway. So the thing is, these can produce heroic yields. In like we're talking like 30, 40 tons a hectare. You know, they were planted for brandy production back in the day. So Colombar was chosen
along with Chenin Blanc. It's one of the first grapes, that was planted.
Because they wanted to make lots of brandy, so the brandy and coke, and they thought that, you know, that this is... but obviously what Saki Mouton's doing is taking these vineyards, planting on quite interesting soils, and along with, you know, all the people in Swartland and everything, where, again, the story there was it's about big production for brandy. People starting to farm these soils with the varieties that are in place is the lens to show them through. And Colombar is not a very distinguished variety, with a view to seeing what sort of terroir can be established, what sort of place can be established. And obviously, I think we've seen with Eben Sardi's old vine series, you know, exploring different terroirs in the Western Cape. And there's some incredible wines coming out of that, because it's a sensitive winemaking. It's listening to the site. It's farming well. And then producing something really interesting. And I think that's very exciting. So you don't need 1,000 years necessarily, but it's like recognising places and then almost developing terroir. So I haven't tried this wine for a while, but...
there are not a lot of neglected grape varieties. Colombard is one. Pedro Jimenez, I guess, is another one in South Africa.
Yeah.
But also, you know, when it was fortified in Spain, well, you don't need good grapes. But imagine you had old vines and you made a dry wine. It's fascinating.
Well, the sherry story is fantastic. The modern story of making unfortified vinos, basically, biologically aged sherries. Because back in the day, vino would have been unfortified. So what they do is they pick the grapes. And this is before big sherry took over in the 70s, expanded the vineyard area. There was these sort of wines of terroir. The pago was important. The wines were made on the pago. People would bring the grapes, they'd lay them out for aceleo for 1 day to get the alcohol potential alcohol up to 15 because that supports floor growth better. Then they'd just press them, make a barrel of wine. Then when the wine had fermented, they'd take it down to Jerez or to San Luca. And then this is the interesting one, is that you've got this idea of the second terroir, because the bodegas were effectively the second terroir.
Yes.
Because the characteristics of the bodega would then influence the layer of floor that grew on the top. So it's effectively a place that's influencing the character of the wine. So vineyards are important. You know, the vineyards there now, people are differentiating amongst the vineyards and six different types of Albarito. And that's kind of cool, I think, this idea of terroir being rediscovered, and also this idea of two terroirs. And that brings into another question, and this is making terroir very complicated, I know, but it's like the idea that local practice can be part of terroir, where that practice is shared amongst all the growers of a place. It helps to shape a wine of place. So you can say immediately, this wine comes, I recognise where this comes from. And part of that character might come from the way that the people tend to work. And they might share that way of working that then produces a level of similarity amongst all their wines that could be described as terroir.
Like the oxidative wines of the Jura.
Yes, that's true. I've got a little vignette about visited some growers in Styria, and I noticed they all had Kvevri, Georgian clay pots, and other amphora receptacles. And they were, in each one of them was a cactus or pot plant, a similar pot plant. I said, why aren't you using them? I said, well, it's not part of the terroir. The terroir is Austrian wood, oak, and it holds the wine and it imbues it with the terroir that, you know, whatever. It's like, it's just a natural match. And when we used these, we felt they were alien to the wine. And I understand that. The sense of place is everything that goes in. And yeah, the winery is very important, a component of terroir. Another small story. We visited Emilio Hidalgo and we said, so your old vines.
There's a sherry producer for those of you who.
Well, oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah. Sherry producer in Jerez.
Yeah.
And we said, you on like whatever Albariza soils. He said, the terroir here is the north facing wall. And he said, like that barrel on the north facing wall, now it's taste one on the sort of south facing wall. They're totally different. You know, this biological aging, sort of, you know, this transformation that goes on. And yes, the terroir is like the point of difference, as we said. And of course, we mainly think about it in terms of the vineyard and the farming, but it can also be in the production process when it's a natural cultural production process.
I mean, imagine an old barrel that's either been used for Vangeaune or for sherry. Like, what's living in that barrel and impacting the flavour? And how that, like, the whole process of just the vessel itself.
Yes.
The journey of the vessel.
I heard this story with Ganava, and I'm not sure it's true. It's probably one of those apocryphal stories. And you know that he has a négociant business, which he runs with his sister. And, you know, they make a lot of different wines, whites and reds. And then if you taste the Domaine wines and then you taste the Negos wines, you think, that's extraordinary. They taste, you know, almost identical. But the Negos wines can be from all over the place. They can be from Beaujolais. They can be from Alsace, from the Rhone. And the story is that Ganava smiled when someone said that his Grenache from the southern Rhone tasted like Poussard. And he said, well, it's vinified with the Ganava yeast. Like the yeast that had been in the winery, you know, extraordinary number of different yeasts sort of working out in the wine, transforming any wine that was made in that winery into Poussard if it's a red wine, and presumably, I don't know, Chardonnay topped up Huillet for a white wine. Extraordinary, like when you taste them side by side. Yes, of course there are nuances, but there's a signature of the winemaker, and not a heavy-handed signature, just of the winery, Lynn.
And what do we think of this? Yeah, you're going to ask the same question as me.
This wine,
what do you think of the Colombard?
I think this is a wine that has a lot of personality, and it's got this saline twist that I really like. It's fresh, it's linear, it's
pithy as well.
Yeah. It's brightly citrusy, green apple.
I like that it's all of that, but there's still some concentration to it as well that's unexpected, at least from my perspective in Colombard, that there's some texture there, because I think often there can be this assumption that it's just kind of very acidic, light, very neutral, but there's
character. Colin Barker makes sweet sour sort of styles. I mean, acidity is really high, I think, in this. But actually, yeah, as Emily said, in the mouth, there's texture, which is also, I think, what you're looking for in terroir. If a wine was just a line of acidity or just tannin or whatever, it would be pretty boring, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be sort of one note. Whereas a wine which has, which what Jamie called salinity or saltiness, which makes you, you know, sort of want to almost chew it a little bit just to sort of get the most out of, that's a really intriguing wine, I think. Mm. And actually, which brings me on slightly to skin contact wines, because one of the accusations levelled against that style of winemaking is that it obfuscates the expression of terroir. What do you think in examples of skin contact wines that you've tried?
I think we haven't had enough access to trying like skin contact wine to actually be able to answer that properly, because until every producer that we're trying white wine from is making an orange wine, how can we actually comment on that? Because I think it probably does, but it's a different expression.
I think I agree completely. I think it's our lack of experience, because we have no problem in ascribing terroir to skin contact reds, skin fermented reds. It's just that with skin fermented whites, you know, skin fermented reds come in a wide diversity in styles, so does skin fermented whites.
To quote Disney, a whole new world.
It's a whole... You're going to sing it for us.
No, saving that for you after we open the second bottle.
Yeah. Will my rendition be a good interpretation of a whole new world, or will it be a flawed interpretation? So I think it's almost like a land grab, isn't it? You know, this like the Wild West. People are going in there and doing lots of things with skin fermentation and learning what works and what doesn't work. And the stylistic diversity is huge, and that's a big hurdle to mount. But I think there's no reason to think that in 15 years' time, 20 years' time, that there'll be a much clearer understanding of you know, what terroir looks like through the lens of skin fermentation in whites.
Do you think maybe also to do with the fact we're not, I mean, we are relatively experienced, but that a lot of people are not experienced at tasting the skin contact wines and are perhaps too hung up on tannin or phenolics, and they can't get past this sort of block of texture. But actually it is in the texture that the terroir nuances will present themselves, but they'll do it in a completely different way than to like a straight pressed wine.
We just need more people to concentrate on making skin fermented whites, and then
more people to taste them.
Yeah, maybe we should try to see if we can spot terroir in a skin fermented red.
Yes, yeah, great. My favourite type of red is skin fermented, by the way.
Can I open it, Doug? Doug bought this wine.
I did, and you may.
And it's Kelly Fox Marsh Vineyard Pinot 22.
Yes, and there's even within Marsh Vineyard there are rows of vines and bits of natural information. So this is golden crowned sparrow block. Okay. Because I believe that when she is harvesting or spending time in her favourite vineyard, these like little critters are chirping away.
There's a beautiful story on the back about how she hears a bird singing in a tree and looks up and then sees these sparrows.
Lovely. This looks good from the start.
Just dropped a drop of it on your very white page there, James.
Okay, a little bit of that.
This is a weird thing to say, but it just occurred to me. Sometimes I look at a wine and it's sort of like clear and transparent, and yet it's not filtered in any way. But there's a sense of the wine, even before I smell it and taste it, that it's going to be delicious. It's really inviting. It's probably because I think there's like the wine is true to itself. It looks like a real wine. And it's a quite indefinable thing to say. You know, you're talking about properties within the wine, which are inside the wine, not external.
Can we talk about Kelly Fox for a second and how magical she is as a human being for anybody that might not have ever had the lucky chance to meet her or taste her wines?
Well, she's listening to this. She can blush now. You may blush, Kelly. Yes. So she's a female vigneron who's worked at various wineries before. She alighted on her own project, Kelly Fox Wines, in Oregon. And Oregon, I would say, is like the epicenter of sort of organic and biodynamic farming. And she's very much, you know, aficionado, that style of wines. But not just for the sake of it, not just to say that she's working in that way, but I think she sees herself as a midwife, if I can use that word, for terroir. You know, she wants to express the soul, the spirit of the vineyard in the wine. And for her, Pinot Noir is the great grape for doing that. It's a grape where you
can... To interrupt, do you think there are some grape varieties that are better at showing terroir than others?
Very good question. I mean, I would say, you know, well, you know, we've talked about Comanche previously, and their contention is that Garnacha in Gredos is the Pinot Noir of Spain. It has this, it's articulate. It shows nuances. Whereas some other grape varieties, yes, they show terroir, but maybe Syrah Shiraz is a much more impactful, straight thing. Maybe it doesn't have sort of layers like this. Maybe it has a sort of gripping minerality. And these wines are, there's a warmth and an openness and a sort of, what's the word? Seductibility? That's not a word.
Yeah, or I think a transparency. But I don't know. I want to question that a little bit, because I think maybe we're a bit biased because of the kind of wines we like to drink are these lighter styles.
Yes.
And I wonder as well, like we've talked about this definitely before, the idea of better grape varieties, right? Like I think as I go on more and more, I'm trying more grapes. I'm trying grapes that I really didn't like. And then all of a sudden I try one producer and I'm like, oh, some of this is actually pretty good. So is it just that some grapes, we haven't quite worked out how to make them shine or for them to be able to showcase it? I don't know.
But we're allowed to have preferences. That's the thing.
Yes.
I mean,
but
aren't we actually, let's talk about maybe girlfriend's like, off track piece.
We want to get you back to Kelly though.
So okay, I'll get me back.
Maybe stick with Kelly before you forget exactly what you're
saying. So Kelly's wines, for me, they have really good energy. And by good energy, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I feel they're like medicinal in the best sense, nourishing. They make me feel good about myself and about wine in general, because they come from a deep place, a beautiful place, obviously a place that she feels impelled to talk about. The song of the sparrows that sort of inspires her. Her love of nature comes through, and the wines taste natural, not in the sense they're natural wines, but naturally from a very specific place that she cares about. So her hand is very, the way she touches the wine, I've seen her work in the vineyards very briefly, and, you know, she sings to the vines, she touches them in a very soft way. And the way she makes the wines is very gentle. You know, it's not about pushing or scrunching or doing like a lot of things to manipulate the wine. It's about what would leave the grapes like almost naked, like as if they perfectly express this vintage, this block of Pinot vines, this environment of nature that surrounds this particular block. How can I capture it without putting my personality into the wine itself? Of course, you can never not do that. Your personality is always in the wine, because it's the choices you make during the growing and the élevage. But I think she so respects nature. She so takes a step away from process that it comes through really eloquently in her wines. And if you taste them blind, I would submit there's something that it's Kelly at this vineyard, marsh, and Oregon. You know, it's all these things and volcanic soils. Yes,
she has
red jewelry clay soils.
This is a beautiful wine. I'm really enjoying this. I think it's got silkiness, it's got finesse, but it's got this bloody iron sort of savoury twist that really throws into relief that beautiful, sweet, silky fruit. And there's a lightness, but also a presence. It's like, it's quite profound. I think this is one of the best Oregon Pinots I've tried. I think it's got a real beauty to it. And
me too.
And this is an intelligent interpretation of place. It doesn't require us to be able to drill down blind to a site, you know, because obviously the thing is we all have limited experience. You know, for that sense of place to be authentic only requires one person in the world to actually reliably recognize that sense of place. Somebody who's very closely connected with that place could probably do that. So if just one person can do it, it's true. For the rest of us, we almost like our sense of terroir is an act of trust. We trust that the wine grower is producing something that's true to its place. And we partake in this. And we were talking about this. You talked some early on, Doug, you mentioned something that I thought was quite profound. It's about the person tasting. It's our perception as well is very important in this.
Mm.
And it's almost like we're doing something. Terroir is, we said, only present when it's interpreted by a wine grower, but it's also only present when it's interpreted by a taster as well. And as we come to taste, it's almost like this sense that we're improvising around the characters in the glass. We're doing some of the work here. When we taste thoughtfully and mindfully, we're doing some of the work in terms of ascribing place to this wine. And that's really interesting for me, this sort of, the sense that we participate in tasting, because it's perfectly possible for somebody to take this and just drink it. Oh, it's red wine. But it's we all have a different experience of this wine, depending on our expectations, depending on our investment in discovering that place and that character.
I think the word investment in discovering is absolutely bang on. I mean, this takes me to a place, and actually a lot of great wines take me to places that I've never been, and somehow I'm transported. I can think of a lot of producers, and it's a wonderful skill to be able to capture place. Mm. I think that's the other thing. Something I would say about this wine, just parenthetically, is remember something that Thierry Germain said. He was talking about biodynamics, but he said, like, red equals life, like the heartbeat, blood. Black is death. It's when the fruit is, like, gone over or the extraction is too high. And for me, red, this is energetic wine. It's sort of like Jamie described, the sort of all the little transitions in the palate, but it's moving. The wine is, like, not static. It's evolving, it's its own character, it's sort of capricious almost. And it's a really beautiful thing, because places are not static. They're like full of life and full of energy. And just to be able to capture that and transform it into wine is one of the greatest skills of all.
Yeah, she's a poet. Yeah. She's poetry, her wine's a poetry. I'm totally biased, but I'm a huge Kelly Fox fan for a number of reasons, because she's a very beautiful individual. And the wines, they always have that Kelly Fox fingerprint for me.
Mm.
Yeah. I just imagine myself in the Japanese mountains or something. There's like this purity and almost minimalism, but in the best sort of sense, like the pared back. Yeah.
And I'm sure, in a way, you're right, because...
Oregon is...
You know, without trying to read a personality, but Kelly loves, Japanese art and philosophy. Mm. And this sort of Zen, almost detachment from the wine. The wine is the wine. The winemaker is taking the steps back and puts the wine on its feet, to use a Georgian expression, and the wine lives by itself. And it lives because it's from a living vineyard.
So we're kind of... We've been on this quite interesting journey over the last 50 minutes or so, where we've taken this concept, and rather than try and narrow it down and define it, we've expanded it into almost a universe of complex interplaying possibilities, like a neural network of ideas. But I think that's very exciting, because what it means to me is, when we come and share a glass of wine together, should we choose to, should that wine have that capacity to do it, to provoke imagination and thought and discussion, then this is truly the ultimate expression of terroir, that a place has given rise to something that then enables us to participate in something that's really quite fun, and is mentally engaging, but is also emotionally and soulfully connecting as well. And this is the other thing, is we're talking about ideas with words, and sometimes it's the words can stop, and we rush to words so quickly as wine professionals. We want to describe what the wine's like, we want to capture it, but then sometimes it's good to be soulful and just to be wordless, and not so good for a podcast, obviously.
To be yes, as we struggle to describe things. I mean, I totally agree. I love intangibility. I love mystery. Mystery is a beautiful, it's almost a religious word. Yeah. And I think we're doing honour to the wines by not trying to pin them down.
Should we rename the podcast words. The Wine Mystics?
Yes. Yeah. We'll get a lot of strange looks. If anyone's listening, by the way.
We could have robes.
Yeah.
So yes, just before we close then, Doug, I mean, you started things. You want to, and Emily as well, you know, what sort of closing remarks would you come with?
Who first?
Oh, you go first.
Okay.
Yes.
I feel that anything that I'm going to add right now would just be very reductive after such a broad conversation. I just think it's a topic, I think, that I hope that we can continue to discuss, because we're just sort of scratching the surface of understanding it, you know, and comprehending it. And I think going back to the point around language, right? And I saw you had a little I saw some of your questions there, Doug, around language and terminology, and I think it's beyond it's beyond definition in a way, which makes it pretty hard to, we all have our own interpretation of what that definition is, but I think that's kind of the beauty of it, like, and that is the mystery of it. But yeah, see, I'm just repeating everything that we've kind of gone over now.
I think when you look at when you read poetry or look at great art or listen to, you know, spellbinding music, you feel it on your pulses and you're in a different mood each time anyway. So your interpretation is different, and different people experiencing the same things will experience different elements. And I feel that terroir is something you feel, you sense, but you can talk about all the physicality of terroir, you know, the soil types till you're sort of blue in the face. It doesn't really make the wine come alive. And for me, like, what makes wine distinctive is the sense that it is a living product. Oh, I hate the word product. Living something or other. Living product, we'll say, anyway. Because it's fluid, it's mutable, it's beautiful. There we are.
That's a great way. Rhyme. Great way to end this podcast.
Yes, exactly.
So, dear viewers, listeners,
yes.
Dear viewers.
Thank you for bearing with us the last hour. I mean, I feel this is a subject we will return to again. Yeah. So, signing out from this podcast, I'm Jamie Good.
I'm Doug Gregg.
I'm Emily Harmon.
And you can find us on Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast.
Cheers.